Well, thank you all for coming, and thank you to Shaw and Ian for inviting me along. It's, as Ian mentioned, I've only been in the UK for a few months, and I've already found that the Japanese studies community is very very generous and welcoming, and I really appreciate that and inviting me tonight as well. Okay, so I'm going to take us back to the 20th of March 1995, when I was a little bit younger. In fact, I was a high school exchange student on the Marunouchi-sen in Tokyo, just a few days into a year-long adventure. I'd come into town from the far reaches of Western Tokyo with the father of my host family. We'd transferred at Shinjuku Station, and we were on our way to our respective destinations of Yotsuya, where I was off to, and Kasumigaseki, where he worked for the Japanese government. And my dad explained that he would usually come in a little earlier to beat the peak hour, but that day had decided to travel in later to show me the way. He typically caught the subway, but because it was less crowded than the above-ground JR network. And this seemed completely implausible to me, hemmed in as we were in a crowded train of black suits and carefully folded newspapers. All appeared normal, or at least as normal as Japanese commuting could appear to a boy from the Australian suburbs, as we departed Shinjuku sometime between 8 and 8:30 a.m. But a few stops later, that changed as the train ground to a halt, one stop before mine, and disgorged all the passengers onto the platform. Now, at the time, I didn't have much Japanese, and so I couldn't understand the announcements. My host father mumbled something about a train accident as we followed the crowds up and out into the early spring air. I wondered if there was a suicide or a crash, but concern soon slipped away as I became distracted by the city. Worried about running late, my dad pointed me in the right direction and hurried off to work. I do not remember much of what happened as I wandered the streets from that point on. Would I have noticed the sirens, disproportionate for a seemingly uneventful morning? Did I think there was something odd about the way people hurried past? Or was I thinking more about the newness of the experience, the brisk air and the early spring flowers, the sights and smells of a new city, or of late teenagedom freed from the careful control, if not the financial dependence, on conservative parents? So, as I understood later, that was the morning when five members of religious sect Omushin Nikyo released toxic sarin gas across the Tokyo subway system, killing 13 people and affecting thousands. Our train was one of the targeted lines, and we missed the actual affected train by just a few minutes. My host father to this day believes he might have been caught up in the gassing if it wasn't for my presence. Now, after that day, my year in Japan continued relatively uneventfully, and that year became nearly 6 years in Japan, spread over the last 17. Yet through those years, and particularly after the events of 11th of September 2001, my mind kept turning back to that spring day of 1995. What exactly had happened that day? What had happened since? Was it remembered as in my memory, as a fleeting shock, a jolt of violence emerging suddenly to puncture the facade of a peaceful nation before subsiding? Or do recollections of that day hold a different cultural meaning? Do they say something about that place called Japan? Do they say something about the time described as a lost decade? How does one even approach the representations of memories, particularly memories of violence? Those are some of the initial thoughts I had when I began to approach the preliminary work of getting my doctoral research together. Ultimately, as Ian said, I finished that last year. Now, the years since 1995 have clouded what I personally experienced that morning. Memories are shaped, of course, not just by their founding events, but by the lives lived beyond. And that process of memory, both shaping and being shaped by the lives of its subjects, is what I explored in my doctoral research and what I want to talk about with you tonight. Now, over the last few years, as my initial encounter became a concerted engagement with a history of that day, my near mist has come to take on a much less important role in the way I conceptualise the events of March 1995. My story now sits somewhere in the background, a kind of amusing, almost anecdote to get these conversations started. It's not the driving force, though, that memories of violence are for others that I will introduce you to today. Now, my paper today is called Sarin no Ato, and it's a way of, has two possible meanings structured around this homophonic meaning of ato. One being the sense of after or post, a datsu frame of historical reference, if we like, and the second being a notion of a trace or a mark left behind. So what I'm going to do today is just to give you a brief summary of my attempts to trace the aftermaths of that day, which is now almost 18 years ago. So just by way of background, just after 8 a.m, as I said, on a cool spring morning in 1995, toxic sarin gas seeped into the stale air of the Tokyo subway system. It moved through train carriages and platforms and into lungs and hearts and brains, tracing a path of violence and pain. The violent traces of the sarin left 13 dead, several dozen seriously injured, and over 6,000 exposed to the gas. In its aftermath, the discursive flow surrounding the incident revealed traces of earlier pasts, of war, of victimization, of imperial violence, of writing, of politics. And these traces also mark bodies, personal, national, and political. The gas, as many of you would be aware, was released by five members of religious sect Aum Shinrikyo under the leadership of Guru Asahara Shoko, which was the adopted name of Matsumoto Chizuo. And that morning they boarded trains at four different stations across the city, all due to intersect at Kasumigaseki, the downtown heart of the Japanese bureaucracy. They more or less simultaneously punctured packages of sarin gas, and in some trains, the trains were quickly taken out of service. Others moved around the city, carrying their packages, and some went on with spilled sarin on the floors. Passengers or staff moved some packages onto station platforms, which caused additional injuries in the stations. Now, fortunately, jabbing plastic bags with sharpened umbrella tips is not the textbook method of poison gas deployment, and so the effect was relatively contained. The gas was also relatively weak, packaged in a highly diluted form. A more effective deployment mechanism, or a gas of higher concentration, could have resulted in significantly higher casualty rates. And over the subsequent weeks, coverage of the incident by the Japanese news media overtook all other stories, including the aftermath of the great Hanshin-Awaji earthquake of January, and often to the detriment of judicious reporting. Endless news specials featured the situation, complete with profiles on cult leader Asahara Shoko, and blanket coverage of a number of follow-on incidents that occurred afterwards. In Japan, the trials of alleged perpetrators have also been covered extensively, with major verdicts reported internationally. Further crimes have subsequently been attributed to Aum, including an earlier sarin gassing in 1994 in the central city of Matsumoto, which killed eight, as well as several murders of former and current Aum members or people investigating the cult. While estimates of the total number of people killed by Aum in some people have argued that it's up to 100, the official government compensation scheme recognised 25 deaths as a result of members of the Aum sect. Now, the fallout from the gassing and associated crimes continues to this day. 13 cult members, including Asahara, have been sentenced to death. All of these have now lost their final appeals and could be hanged any day. The only thing that's really arguably preventing their executions is the recent arrest of the final few fugitives who are on the run for most of the last 17 years. Victims groups continue to support the ongoing medical and psychiatric needs of survivors, and have also struggled with the government and with Aum directly over compensation claims. In May 2008, the Tokyo District Court approved a final settlement of 1.5 billion yen to victims of the cult, which was only about 40% of what the original court had ordered in terms of compensation. Subsequently, the government and opposition parties united the following month to unanimously pass legislation providing victims with the remainder of the compensation that Aum was unable to pay. Aum has reformed as Aleph, renounced violence in 2000, and then has subsequently split again, and there are now two organisations, Aleph and Hikari no Wa. Both groups remain under special police surveillance. Now, these basic facts are all well documented in both academic and popular accounts. But for me, what I found interesting was that little work had been done on how the incident was being remembered politically or culturally, or how these processes of remembering shaped the meaning of the incident and its aftermaths. This limited academic attention contrasts with wide and varied cultural responses in Japan. From popular manga, such as Nijuseiki Shonen, 20th Century Boys, to literary works from authors as varied as Murakami Haruki, Oe Kenzaburo, Taguchi Randi, and Kakuta Mitsuo. A whole range of stuff. And these cultural responses formed the bulk of my research corpus, although I was particularly interested on the large number examining the large number of life writing texts, commemorative practices, and memorial processes that emerged in response to the gassing. In the process of filling this gap in understandings of how these incidents are remembered and made sense of in contemporary Japan, I also then engaged with a larger set of questions that relate to the incident's temporal location in a time marked by shifts in understandings of politics, economics, history, and society. The particular relationship between memory and violence is one that looms large in 20th century Japanese history and politics. This relationship is often couched narrowly within frameworks that relate memories of violence to specific cultural responses to the Asia-Pacific wars and the legacies of war defeat. For much of this body of work, both popular and academic, the post-war serves as a rhetorical marker for a set of contestations about nation, politics, and history that relate an unending and consistent, if contested, cultural relation to war and its memories of imperialism, militarism, and aggression to a set of contemporary tensions in the place called Japan. These historical contestations exist over memories of war and its aftermath, as well as through debates over key terms, such as war responsibility, sensor sekinin. While the particular understandings of these terms vary, a simple distinction can be made between two camps, I guess, that see sekinin, as James Orr puts it, either as the moral responsibility for waging a war of aggression or the strategic responsibility of losing it. But as responsibility, however understood, must be founded on some relation to the past, tension also exists in understandings of the nature of memory itself. This is often constructed as a tension between the pseudoscientific search for historical fact, as some see the work of historians, and what people like Pierre Nora have described as a large-scale popular shift from the historical to the remembered and from the remembered to the commemorative. This tension serves for some to mark an epistemological boundary between history and what, after large-scale interest in recent decades, has come to be called memory studies. This divide is marked on one side by a historical focus on rationality and interpretation, and on the other by an interest in the emotional and subjective. But as Tessamura Suzuki has argued, however, representations of the past have always involved both an intimate interconnection and a certain tension between interpretation and identification. A third tension arises in how memories of violence are relayed through media. Morris Suzuki again has pointed out a skeptical tendency in historical analysis towards those forms of historical media that more actively evoke an emotional response in their audiences. Like Morris Suzuki, however, I'm resistant to these historical barriers. I share the belief that all mediatized representations of the past, whether oriented to empiricist fact-finding or affective relation, equally do, or at least can, implicate us as readers in the processes of history. As a range of memory studies theorists, including Susanna Radstone and Annette Kuhn, have pointed out, we understand and relate to the past not simply through historical narrative, but also through a broad and disparate range of textual representations of the past. These memory texts include, but are not limited to, photos, diaries, songs, oral testimonies, letters, and memoirs. In the context of contemporary Japan, tensions around war memory are readily apparent in conflicts over how history is told, and I don't need to tell people in this room, over debates over the emergence of new or recurring nationalist politics, Japan's remilitarization, or any number of other things. And these tensions also seep through into broader debates around issues of cultural representation, such as how best to commemorate past violence and loss, or interpret the meaning of those histories. Underlying the confusing and somewhat confused historical relationship of memory and history of war and its post is a set of attitudes that also relate these memories to the construction of political subjectivities. Contemporary politics in Japan is always already constructed in relation to this idea of the post-war. And in this national post-war, political action occurs on the terrain of an historical relation of victim and victimizer, a difficult middle ground between the knowledge of Japanese imperial atrocities and the awareness of the suffering of the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, say, and of others in Japan in the years since the war defeat. Now, in reading the vast literature on these questions, it is tempting to reject some of these discursive frames entirely. The post-war, for example, is possibly meaningless in the context of a Japan increasingly marked by economic stagnation and social instability, with little connection to that earlier history of violence and colonization. Similarly, the binary of victim and perpetrator, as with all binaries, limits our capacity to critically understand the complexities of situations of victimization and the perpetration of violence. However, I suggest that these discursive markers of the post-war, of victimization, of memory, continue to shape understandings of past pain in contemporary Japan. They also constrain the ways in which traces of the past can be represented in the present. And ultimately, I'm concerned with this relationship of discursive construction and constraint. Now, the subway sarin incident occurred in the context of what some have come to see as an epochal shift in the post-war, the year 1995. This year, as I mentioned previously, was marked by several historically significant events and markers. It opened with the great Hanshin-Awaji earthquake, which killed over 6,000 people and exposed limitations of the post-war Japanese state to effectively respond to crisis. The long, slow decline of post-war Japanese economic power had begun several years earlier, but was signposted most clearly in 1995 by the release of the Japanese Business Federation's neoliberal model of economic reform, the subsequent implementation of which arguably exacerbated social inequalities and tensions. The year also marked the 50th anniversary of the end of the war, bringing to the surface a series of unresolved tensions, both within Japan and between the Japanese state and citizens of its former colonies and enemies. And then the fourth key moment of 1995 occurred on those five trains moving below the urban centre of Tokyo. The Chikitetsu Sarin Jiken, the subway sarin incident, came to represent a series of perceived failings of post-war Japan, failings that were failings of society, of religion, and of the state. The incident also serves for me as a way to explore the traces and tensions with which I began this paper. How does war memory impact on later memories of violence? What can memory texts and practices tell us about the past and about history? And how do the forms in which memory is represented shape and constrain our understandings of past experiences? It is important to stress that I've not attempted to construct an historical narrative of the incident itself. This has been done well by several others. It's also not an attempt to understand the reasons why the incident occurred through exploring the cult responsible, the society that produced it, or the phenomenon of terrorism. This work has also been done. Instead, I'm interested in how the past is represented culturally and how these representations are constructed historically and discursively. Now, to get at these questions, I'm going to discuss a few short examples of how memory texts and practices in Japan shaped responses to the subway gassing, and then conversely, how these responses in turn shaped texts and practices themselves. But before I do that, I wanted to just do a quick kind of sketch of a genealogy of life writing and memorial practices that's explored in a lot more depth in my dissertation. Well, we might point to long autobiographical traditions that extend to the poetic diaries of the Heian period. However, there are some clear and basic differences between the genealogies of generic forms of life writing in Western cultures and in Japan. In contrast to Europe, where the codification of a genre of autobiographical writing had taken place in the 18th century, there was not the same kind of epistemological and literary consensus in Japan, such as the distinction between fiction and autobiography, as Tomi Suzuki has argued in her discussion of the Watashi Shosetsu, the I novels popular in early 20th century Japan. Livia Monet has also pointed out that forms of historical self-writing, such as poetic diaries, often blurred the West's perceived distinction of autobiography and fiction, intertwining the recording of experience with motivations of aesthetics. For Richard Baring, these forms were also characterized by core tropes of waiting and feminine passivity. But in a lot of these historical genres, fiction and life writing are intimately bound together. Vera Mackey, however, points to the danger of relying entirely on historical antecedents when discussing modern and contemporary autobiographical forms. As historical circumstances change, so do the ways in which people write in response to these changes. In Mackey's discussion of the autobiography of prominent Meiji period feminist and activist Fukuda Hideko, she argues that the generic conventions of the Heian poetic diaries were not appropriate to the writing of a political life in Meiji Japan. In particular, she points to the distinction between the gendered tropes identified in poetic diaries and the focus on action in Fukuda's autobiography. Early 20th century women did not describe their lives in the same terms of passivity as the elite women of 1,000 years earlier. In terms of structure, too, the poetic diary's cyclical nature was replaced by a linear structure more in tune with the quest novel. So for Maki, Fukuda and writers like her in the early 20th century were writers carefully constructing texts that drew on novelistic and melodramatic conventions. However, these conventions were not restrained to indigenous traditions. They drew on a much wider range of international autobiographical models, including the growing field of socialist autobiographies structured around the awakening of authors to socialist ideals. So in Mackey's work around autobiographical and other writings of activist women in the early 20th century, two key themes emerge. Writing can act as a process to help forge identity, and writing also creates spaces for struggles about reality within texts shaped by generic constraints. Now, the Meiji period saw the beginnings of an increased appeal of modern romantic notions of the individual self. and this appeal was structured at least in part around processes of writing. James Fuji argues against popular understandings of Japan as group-oriented that through the last century, individualism has been adopted as a powerfully attractive ideal, whether it finds popular expression as an insistent and revealing emphasis on kosei, or when it appears repeatedly as the subject of scholarly discourse. In considering then how to read contemporary life writing forms in Japan, like the subway gassing ones, it's important to historically contextualise the processes of writing. As Sidonie Smith and Julia Watson have argued, life narratives might best be approached as a moving target, a set of ever-shifting self-referential practices that engage the past in order to reflect an identity in the present. In Japan, from at least the late 19th century, indigenous traditions of life writing in the form of poetic diaries and other antecedents were connecting with post-Enlightenment processes of self-transformation and self-regulation, manifest in autobiographical approaches framed by modernist ideologies. And in these forms, literary subjectivity was a core feature in the development of political subjectivity. And as we move into the post-war, we can see that this relationship between literary and political subjectivities continues through much of the history of Japan. Personal testimony served in the immediate post-war as a means by which everyday experiences could be relayed to the public, with limited access to information under restrictions put in place by the Allied occupation. The publication in 1949 of the edited collection Kike Waratsumi no Koe, Listen to the Voices from the Sea, is one well-known example. And later, personal testimonies came to shape understandings of a range of post-war political fault lines. The narration of stories featured as a core element in the political organising of victims of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, as I'll touch on below. And in the post-war period, history writing also took on a personal tone, focused increasingly on recording everyday experiences in what was termed people's history, or minshushi. Marxist historians in the immediate post-war period organised national campaigns referred to as the People's History Movement, which aimed at deprofessionalising history writing through a focus on individual workplace and local community histories. History, or at least the idea of this movement, was to demystify history through its deployment in exploring the material conditions of everyday life. Understandings of the past and how to write and document the past transformed from the period before the end of the war, when formal documentary history served the interests of a militarised state, to a post-war deployment of personal experience, myth, legend and oral traditions in the interests of the people. And by the late part of the 20th century, these genealogies of life writing forms in Japan coalesced in a popular boom of a form of life writing known as jibunshi, self or I history. And the emergence of jibunshi as a popular form has been traced to a citizens' movement in Hachioji, not far from where I started on that trains on the 20th of March 1995, referred to as fudangi, the recording the everyday, and which emerged in the 1960s. Now, the specific nature of the jibunshi boom and its connections to a reborn and reified folklorism is beyond the scope of what I can talk about today. But what is relevant, I think, is the way in which this popular movement captured two concurrent historical trends. On the one hand, there's a connection to this earlier minshushi phenomenon. As George Figala's described it, this was a move from people's history, to history of the people by professional historians, to people's history and historiography, history of and by the people. But on the other hand, there's a shift to an individualised mode of writing centred on the place of the individual subject in an historical context. So what becomes apparent through this discussion, I think, in Japan of life narratives is that they exist within a particular historical genealogy of writing and of conceptualising the self. From the late 19th century, these historical forms of life writing based on aesthetics and gendered passivity came up against modern forms that were interested in the development of the self through writing in the context of the novel and autobiography. And it's no surprise that this occurred as Japan came into contact and sustained engagement with notions of selfhood shaped by the Enlightenment. In the growth of personal narratives with a political purpose through the 20th century, we see a connection between the literary subject constructed through these various methods and the political one, shaped both by experience and the testimony of experiences recorded in words. Through all of these historical trajectories, the emphasis is one of change. As circumstances changed, so processes of dealing with these changing circumstances in writing also evolved. So in the remainder of the time I have today, I want to take you into just one section of my research to highlight how collections of victim stories changed over the years since 1995. I'm going to focus most closely on two particular edited collections produced under the auspices of the Chikatet Society in Jigenhigaishinokai, the Subway Sarin Incident Victims Association. Now, this association first met in January 1996 with the aims of supporting those with ongoing medical and psychological needs, as well as those mourning the loss of loved ones. Its members included victims and family members of those affected by the incident, and they had connection with other victims groups, including those affected by the Matsumoto incident the year before. The group did not intend to provide direct medical aid, which it argued was the role of the state, or financial support, which it argued was the responsibility of Aum. But instead, their focus was to agitate politically for ongoing awareness of the incident in Japan and appropriate recognition, aid and compensation for victims, survivors and their families. The early years of the Victims Association involved a range of activities designed to bring people together through meetings and symposia. These meetings led to discussion of victim dissatisfaction with the way their stories were being told or ignored in the aftermath of the incident. For the year after the gassing, the media was saturated with stories about perpetrators, the incident and the cult responsible. However, from the victim's perspective, stories of survivors and victims remained rare. As an initial response to this relative silence, victims produced a collection of stories, fundraising enough money for 1,000 copies, 500 to be distributed to victims and 500 to the general public, on the second anniversary of the gassing in 1997. After this initial collection attracted interest from around Japan and overseas, the association decided to produce a volume with new stories, which became the 1998 publication Sore demo ikiteiku, Chikatetsu Sarin Jikken Higaisha Shukishu, which I've translated as We Will Survive No Matter What, Memoirs of the Victims of the Subway Sarin Incident. Now, this is a collection of 39 individual stories with an introduction by the official spokesperson Takahashi Shizue and an afterword by the head of the victim's legal support group. Now, Takahashi was married to a deputy station master named Kazumasa. He died attempting to remove the packages of sarin from the station platform at Kasumigaseki. Takahashi has been the face of the Victims Association since its inception, and she's published her own autobiography. There's lots about her that people are interested, documentaries and so on. But with the exception of Takahashi and Nakamura, this first collection of stories are grouped into three sections. Those left behind, which is about those whose loved ones died, those watching over, people who are caring for the injured, and those living on, so the survivors. None of the authors are named, with their stories marked simply by an age range, a gender, and where relevant, relationship to the victim or survivor. Now, Takahashi reported the motivations of the group in putting this collection together as multiple, from a desire to focus on the then lack of meaningful government support to looking at the role of the media. But ultimately, she said, her fear was that, quote, as we approach the third anniversary of the incident, it may be beginning to slip away from people's memories. The function of the collection was to produce stories that challenged this mnemonic oblivion through the production of a victim that could be related to by readers. And as the stories were developed, however, they came to draw on earlier stories that resonated with people's memories, stories intimately tied to histories of victimisation. This volume was produced with the assistance of a woman called Aoki Yumiko, a professional editor. And while her work was not credited in the original publication, she also assisted with a second volume that the group put out, 2007's The Subway Sarin Incident and Me, which I'm going to talk a little bit about in a moment. In this 2007 work, she provided a brief introduction entitled The Role of Books, Honno Yakuwari. And in it, she reflects on the reasons why she agreed to assist with this volume and the role of writing and publishing in engaging with memories of the past and the politics of the present. Aoki recalls that as she worked on the first volume, her mind kept returning to a book she remembered from her childhood, the collection of children's Hiroshima stories called Watashi ga chisakatta toki ni. So literally, when I was small. I think in English it's called When I Was a Kid or When I Was a Child, edited by Osada Arata. Now, Aoki writes, I have not known war or nuclear bombs, but in order to develop an understanding of that cruelty, that pain, I read Osada's book over and over again as a child. Swamped as we are by coverage of this incident through television, newspapers and magazines, books, which by their very nature allow us to sit and slowly read, function to keep the voices of victims alive for future generations. That is why I came to be involved with this incident. She goes on to reflect on the professional skills she associates with her work as an editor, being tactful, capacity for listening, attention to detail and so on. But for her, participation in the collection of victims' stories reveals the limits of those skills. She wrote, being before people as they pry open their hearts, laying bare the pain of lost family and the scars of being suddenly exposed to the risk of death, there were days when I could do nothing but hold back my tears and acknowledge that I was listening. Aoki's solution was to abandon her role as this dispassionate editor and confront the incident, in her words, as my naked self. For Aoki, the power of victim narratives lies in their rawness, as free from editorial or other mediation as possible. Aoki believes she will always be connected to this incident, motivated by a desire that people without a direct connection not forget this misfortune may have happened to anyone. Now, in Aoki's recollection of the Osada book, we see an explicit reference to an implicit genealogy of victim narratives that extends to the loss of World War II, and most notably, the narratives of Hiroshima and Nagasaki victims. In the introduction to John Whittier Treat's 1995 discussion of Japanese literature related to the atomic bomb, writing Ground Zero, he spends considerable time discussing the relationship between writing and legacies of the war, drawing a particular comparison between the well-discussed connection between Holocaust testimony and practices of life writing and the less articulated relationship of these practices to the atomic bomb. He notes that where the Holocaust was immediately international, as victims were both drawn from multiple parts of the world and ended up in them, the process of reflecting on the possibility that the human species may not last into the next century fell mainly on the Japanese. This was due in part to the fact that discussion of potential future nuclear holocaust did not serve the interests of the war victors as easily as the very real, but immediately historic, as in over, Holocaust of Europe. Dominic LaCapra points out that the value of testimony is not in the revelation of purely documentary knowledge, if such a thing could actually exist, but instead, testimonies are significant in the attempt to understand experience and its aftermath, including the role of memory and its lapses in coming to terms with or denying and repressing the past. Culturally, this has resulted in an explosion of work around memory, trauma, and the subjective legacies of the past, both in relation to the Holocaust and in broader connection to other traumatic histories. This body of work is characterized by a reliance on the telling of stories, either by survivors themselves, by those who witness, or by those they entrust to tell their stories. In this act of telling, survivors confront guilt at survival, claim political agency, and in LaCapra's terms, come to terms with the past. For historians, there's a role for these stories, not in determining the objective facts of the past, but in assessing how they enable an engagement with the affect of history, and in the ways in which they provoke a response in readers and listeners. Anger, sadness, exhilaration, whatever. As LaCapra argues, there's a crucial role for empathic unsettlement as an aspect of understanding, which stylistically upsets the narrative voice and counteracts harmonizing narration or unqualified objectification, yet allows for a tense interplay between critical, necessarily objectifying reconstruction and the affective response to the voices of victims. The social authority of practices of life writing, and particularly in forms of autobiography, derives from their effective effect on readers, which in turn is based on their claims to authenticity. As Lee Gilmore has described it, this authority is drawn from autobiography's relation to culturally dominant discourses of truth-telling, and not from its privileged relation to real life. For authors, this claim is both cultural and personally specific. As Gilmore argues, for many writers, autobiography's domain of first-person particularities and peculiarities offers an opportunity to describe their lives and their thoughts about it, to offer in some cases corrective readings, and to emerge through writing as an agent of self-representation. A figure textual to be sure, but seemingly substantial, who can claim, "I was there," or "I am here." In Aoki's statements above, we can see echoes of this, both in her description of a naked approach to witnessing and in her reference to an established, culturally dominant mode of truth-telling captured in the Hiroshima narrative. A particular connection lies in how writers construct their narratives around place and time. In Treat's discussion of Hiroshima, he points out a curious relationship to distance present in all accounts of the experiences of those present at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, a relation that reflects the personal and public tasks that infuse bomb victim writings with testimonial urgency. In these authors' writings, each tells us as if that place both permits and curbs the words to follow where they were on the morning of August 6th or 9th, 1945. This where is expressed in as a measure of how far from or close to ground zero the writer stood or sat or slept. And this distance is not simply a question of proximity to danger, to the arbitrary lines between life, disfigurement, and death. It's also, Treat tells us, a determiner of the meaning attached to the event. There is meaning in language, as greater distance from the silent epicenter parallels the greater ease with which the victim of nuclear war can speak of the fact of that day. And there is meaning in the multitude of other ways the survivor of atrocity may seek to reconcile experience, memory, guilt, and rage with and against those inherited cultural systems of mediation incongruent with such lived reality. For Alki, the requirement for nakedness in approaching these texts reflects the difficulty that proximity causes for storytelling. The nakedness of the editor, and presumably the reader, approximates a physical exposure, never equivalent to, but approaching the exposure of the victims. And it's through this approximation of exposure that the reader can come into contact with the experience of the author. Yet this nakedness also testifies to the impossibility of relating the actuality of experience. The first volume of Orm stories all follow a similar pattern, starting with that day and moving through anecdotes of post-incident life to reveal the reality that life continues but is changed in significant ways. A male photographer in his 30s recounts his experience of photographing the scene on that day, only to find his post-incident photography marred by blurred vision and nerves. A company worker in his 40s calls on the government and the police to stop picking on the weak. An elderly woman in her 70s wonders how she is to care for her comatose daughter when she struggles to walk to the station by herself. Her son, the victim's brother, realises that it will be his responsibility and wonders in front of his children if maybe it would have been better if his sister had died. So as with the Hiroshima stories, the narratives all orient from a physical location, either the sites of the gassings themselves or the location of the writer when news of the incident reached them. All right. Some of the authors, though, pen impassioned pleas for explanation, seek answers or justice, or want to express their anger. But for most, the opportunity to tell their story is about correcting a perceived media bias in favour of perpetrators and simply making the public aware of the complexities of their lives. Takahashi Shizue describes victim fears that their experiences would be lost to history, forgotten by a society caught up in the sensation of the event and the media hype surrounding the perpetrators. I did my best to contribute to media reports, but felt there was a limit to how much I could speak for other victims. With the determination not to allow our stories to be forgotten, we overcame this unease and decided to write our stories ourselves. Now, these self-produced stories are necessarily brief, short snippets of life punctured by violence. Take the case of a 6-year-old boy whose aunt was made seriously ill by the gassing. He writes a couple of years later at age 9, "I was able to see Shizu-chan on Saturday, but Shizu-chan was broken. I thought it couldn't be her, but it was Shizu-chan, a lifeless Shizu-chan." The primary motivation of victim writing in 98 was to carve out a public space for victim memory, to centre victim stories in narratives of the event, and to make the public aware of its aftermath. And this is done primarily through an orientation to that day, through space and time. But 9 years later, as the association again came to publish a collection of stories, the focus had shifted, as had Takahashi's tone. In the later volume, she argued, "Many people from a number of positions and with a range of opinions have helped revive the shock of the subway sarin incident." Or the subway sarin incident and me, or what the subway sarin incident is to me, was not published directly by a publisher. It emerged as a self-published collection produced by the association with the assistance of legal support groups and the original publisher of the first volume. Now, while there is some continuity in the nature of the stories gathered, the bereaved, those struggling to assist the injured, and so on, the second collection is marked by a shift in both the nature of the stories and the work of life narrative. The sarin incident and me takes a broader look at who was affected by the gassing, including stories of those directly affected, near misses, those watching from afar, and those touched by the incident, however tangentially. It includes well-known figures such as author Murakami Haruki, Japanese Prime Minister at the time of the gassings, Murayama Tomiichi, and prominent journalists Egawa Shoko and Arita Yoshifu, along with everyday folk, including housewives, students, and salaried workers. A number still chose to remain anonymous, as with the first book, but the numbers were significantly reduced. Only 6 of the 54 stories were unnamed. The narrative shift in the second volume is marked in Takahashi's preface, where she outlines a continuation of her earlier concerns with social forgetfulness, but identifies a shift in the meaning of the incident for victims. She relays stories of numerous people approaching her at public presentations and making comments like, "I was so lucky to have been on the train before the one that was gassed," or possibly stories like mine. These comments led her to think that almost anyone would be able to relay what they were doing at the time of the gassing. Proximity was no longer so important in victim narratives, as traces of the incident were well spread throughout Japanese society, and the meaning of the event had shifted to a point of shared experience. The challenge for victims 12 years later was not to avoid oblivion, their stories were remembered at least generally, but to revive the feeling of shock which they felt was needed for a re-engagement with their concerns. These concerns included the then ongoing battles for compensation, the impact of continued after effects, and fears of a return to violence. Now, the need for a generalized awareness of their experience was no longer the motivator. Instead, it was a need for fear. As Takahashi commented in her introduction, memories of that day may be so clearly remembered because everyone experienced the same sense of fear. But now, well, the first book was maybe prompted by a desire not to be forgotten, and the second by this motivation of fear, the solution is the same, a process of storytelling and speech. She saw these acts as essential for both victims and society more broadly. In her introduction to the later volume, she attributes a quote to Martin Luther King, "Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter," before expounding on what this means for victims. "It was bad luck. If I'd just left the house a little earlier, I wouldn't have been on the train. The system and the law are just this way, and there's nothing we can do about it." She writes, "I think victims just accept these things, bottle up their injuries inside, and stay silent. Victims lost their lives and bodily functions to sarin, were affected by psychological after effects, and suffered economic losses. And 12 years later, this is continuing. We must communicate this through words and action." So the role of victim storytelling was no longer simply about revealing the truth of what happened, but it shifted to a much stronger emphasis on the days since. This later volume is less clearly structured than the earlier volume, with all contributions other than Takahashi's preface ordered simply by the Japanese kana syllabary. Those using abbreviated names or choosing to remain anonymous are grouped at the rear of the volume. This simple structure results in a somewhat awkward opening to the book and a curiously disjointed reading experience. The first piece is a piece by Akita Junichi, a man in his 30s, who contributes a story about his Shinkansen trip on the day of the gassings to the southern Japanese island of Kyushu. On a typical day, he might have been caught up in the incident changing trains at Kasumigaseki. He writes, "It was only by chance that I wasn't on the train that day. I believe the fact that I'm living like I am, that I'm writing this piece, is down to nothing more than chance." And the roles of chance and fate weave through many of the other stories in both positive and negative ways. In the second volume of Victim Narratives, and I'm coming towards the end, like the first, there are many of these stories of loss, of living with injury, of ongoing pain. But interspersed with these are the stories of people like Akita above, the near misses and casual observers. While at times awkward, this gives readers a sense of a forced broadening of the range of victim narratives. This forced broadening was caused in part, I suggest, by external factors, such as the events of 11 September 2001, and the not too subtle co-option of the name Ground Zero for another site of mass death. Terrorism after 9/11 came to supplant annihilation at the hands of state-possessed nuclear weapons as the major fear in public consciousness, and the organising principle of state power. And in doing so, it continued the performative, dehumanised perversity of nuclear annihilation while reincorporating the human dimensions of the state-backed terrorism of the Holocaust, by which I mean a highly personal, direct and interactive violence as opposed to a distant, alienated bomber flying above a city. But this new trope of political violence has come to mark contemporary life in different ways. The power of states to dehumanise is no longer the central concern of politics. Instead, contemporary life is defined by a relation to the abstract, non-state forms of dehumanisation labelled terrorism that have occasionally punctured the illusion of non-violence at the heart of liberal states of the West and Japan. At the same time, the increasing invasiveness of state power, justified as a response to this perceived threat, is downplayed or ignored. and with the focus on 9/11 overshadowing all other instances of violence, serving at best as a point of departure for a discussion, the meaning of the subway gassings are also transformed to conform to this frame. Writes one contributor, a journalist, "Living in France, I watched the news from my home country with a heavy heart. Before the terrorist act, I already thought Japan was fragile in comparison to Europe. While you could not say that in France terrorism was an everyday thing, as in places like Israel or Iraq, people do live with the threat of terrorism." Similarly, the Japanese Prime Minister in 95, Murayama, writes, "I'm participating in this volume so that in this peaceful country, memories of the sarin incident won't fade, and a terrorist incident that causes harm to regular citizens will not happen again." The fear in these narratives is not really about Orm. It's more of a fear about the violence of terrorism was broadening to the unexpected everyday violence-free lives of middle-class urbanity in the cities of the West, which includes the fragile Japan. Now, while the brevity of the contributions in this later volume do not lend themselves to lengthy political arguments, there is a sense that the contributors are unified by feelings of shock and fear at this broadening. Implicit in their narratives is a political demand for state protections. And while the references to fragility and the loss of safety can be traced to the post-9/11 world order, there's also an implication that something within Japan has changed, with an implicit reference to contemporaneous concerns about social and economic instability. Regardless of the context, the construction of narratives remains important for victims. Odaira Takeshi, in his 40s by the 2007 volume, deploys the term kataru, or narrate, in his piece, entitled, "I Want to Continue Narrating as a Fellow Victim." I think we need to continue telling or narrating our stories as fellow victims so that this is not forgotten and so that it does not happen again. And this desire to narrate can also be read in the context of earlier projects of narration. Lisa Yonayama discusses a moment of change in the 1980s when the Hiroshima victim group Katarukai began to break from a position marking their experiences singular and originary to see them as simply one part of a broader concern with nuclear weapons and technology. This move, she writes, obscures questions regarding the legitimacy of speakers and the authenticity of narrative content, allowing the association's membership to extend beyond those who might congregate around the concerns limited solely to Hibakusha or to the immediate witnesses of Hiroshima's atomic bombings. Listeners and readers in this framework of narration are also potential participants in creating narratives of meaning relating to the event. And I suggest a similar process took place with the shift in the subway victim collections. Now, that this place has taken place in just 15 years may reflect an acceleration in the pace of contemporary memory practices or of contemporary life itself. Alternatively, it may be that the pre-existing work done by Hiroshima victims in broadening narratives of victimization laid the cultural groundwork for later replicated processes in the sarin groups. Or more cynically, the events of 9/11 may have provided an impetus for people to relate to the earlier victims of terrorism. Thank you.